that here at 2SEN.
It's very good. Yeah, so, but that version of Australia.
On the Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with business, finance, and the economy. On the Money is recorded live from the studios of Radio 2SER nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Sophia Tarek, and coming up on the program this week...
We need to provide a framework where the directors and the management of these government-owned corporations can make decisions in the best interests of the corporation and its stakeholders.
Last year, it was revealed in Senate estimates that Australia Post had given Cartier watches to top executives. Now, the former CEO is saying that the government was looking into privatising the postal service. Also on the program...
And that setting was turned on by default, but Google hasn't disclosed this information to the customer.
Recently, Google has been in the news after a federal court ruling found that Google had misled some Android users about how to disable personal location tracking. This case raises questions about personal data collection and the influence that tech monopolies have in Australia. Stay tuned for all this and more coming up on the Money. But first... Foreign Minister Maurice Payne announced that Australia would be tearing up a number of agreements made between Victoria and foreign countries. The one most likely to cause a reaction is the agreement with China over the Belt and Road Initiative. Maurice Payne said she didn't anticipate any pushback from China, but given the events over the last year, Roderick Chambers asked UTS industry professor Tim Harcourt whether he thought China would just let this one go through the keeper or whether it would react.
They're going to carry on a bit, I think, but ultimately they expected it. And it's highly likely that if a province of China had tried to sign an agreement with the Commonwealth of Australia, that would have lasted as long as the European Super League in soccer. You know what I mean?
They wouldn't
like it the other way.
Yeah.
Not very long at all. So it's not surprising. But there will be, you know, China will use every opportunity right now for a bit of wolf warrior diplomacy, so it'll be a nice little thing to carry on about for a little while. But they knew it was coming.
So if they were going to respond, what sort of industries could be in the firing line, do you think?
Well, they're not going to harm anything that's really important to China. At the moment, 70% of imports of iron ore come from Australia for China because Brazil's had issues with Vale and COVID. So at the moment... China needs us just as much as we need them. And so if they target anything, it'll be relatively small exporters, many of whom have already been able to find alternative markets when we saw some of the action on barley and wine earlier in the year, late last year.
I mean, are we really being that much of an irritant to China, or are we... part of the larger game with global relations with the US and so forth?
Well, I think it's a larger game. I think you've seen China have disputes with the Czech Republic, with France, with South Korea, with Japan, with Ecuador. You know, you name it, they're having a dispute with them. So I think it's just part of a geopolitical game rather than anything economic. And they're going to be very careful not to harm their own economic interests in the process.
What support could we expect from the US if there is some further sanctions on our industries?
I don't think US has been all that good in helping us, actually. I mean, a lot of the time, they definitely have strong defence ties with us, but in agriculture and other aspects of trade, they tend to just do what is in the interest of the US. So I think in some ways Australia's got to be a middle economic power, an independent player in the region. And whilst the US will be important to us defence-wise, I think economically we've just got to rely on multilateral institutions and being a good, honest broker like we have been, and like we have been with many of the Asian Pacific partners like Japan and South Korea and the ASEAN nations.
And you mentioned that iron ore exports are steaming ahead, and I think they're at some of the best prices we've ever seen here. Is this going to give the government a trove of cash that's going to cover some of the COVID drag that we've got on the economy?
Yeah, I've interviewed the head of Fortescue, Elizabeth Gaines, for my show after the pandemic about China and Australia. And, she says times have never been better for Fortescue. So I imagine that times will be very good for the budget revenue in terms of the high iron ore price. That will certainly make Josh Frydenberg's job a lot easier.
Is it going to provide a much-needed shot in the arm for the WA economy?
Oh, definitely already. I think West Australia's pretty strong, but it will help even more. So it will be some counter to some of the COVID drag that we've seen, particularly in rocks and crops, particularly in mining, which is continues to, hold up Australia against external shocks.
Of course, the demand is a result of supply problems in Brazil, but it's also a result of a big domestic construction stimulus that China is embarking on, I suppose, to revive their economy. How long do you think this will last for?
Oh, yeah, this is transformational. A nation of shippers relying on exports becomes a nation of shoppers, really booming their gene up their domestic economy with domestic consumption and investment. So hence, the need for energy efficiency, the need for iron ore from the Pilbara to stoke the Chinese industrial engine.
So what, like a year, 2 years, more than that?
Oh, probably longer. And the shippers to shoppers phenomenon is, 15, 20 years in the making. So it's quite a large impact that has, global economic impacts and has, for the most part, been very good for Australia, given the huge boom in commodity prices and boom in terms of trade.
The current agreement that was torn up was about the Belt and Road Initiative.
Oh, I think it's important to have sister state-provincial relationships, such as South Australia's relationship with Shandong, that we made an airport economist episode on. Just different if you have a province and a country, It's not quite the right level. So I'd say that, Victoria doing a partnership with an equivalent province in China would probably be quite a good idea.
Globally, what is China expecting out of Belt and Road? Is it just an audacious attempt to control the transport to their factories?
Yeah, look, it's a new Silk Road, if you like. It's basically wanting to set up an amazing network of influence, from China, in sort of reverse Marco Polo style, back to Europe. And in some ways, it's audacious. In some ways, China wants a bit more respect for shaping international institutions. But in some countries' cases, it's been quite dangerous because they've, at least their ports and airports and taken loans from China that have managed China to take out assets. So for some countries, it's a bit of a debt trap, so probably worth avoiding.
And do you think we'll then be over this by this time next year, or are we into a longer period of difficult relations with China?
Look, I think ever since Gough Whitlam recognised Beijing, or Peking as it then was, we've had ups and downs. Gough Whitlam himself was neither a Sinophobe nor a Sinophile, as Stephen Fitzgerald famously said. John Howard and Paul Keating, Kevin Rudd, right through to Scott Morrison have all had their bumps in the road. But for the most part, the partnership has been successful and our living standards have improved. And, of course, Chinese living standards have been out of sight. So we should never lose sight of the fact that the Australian relationship's been very good for China, as it has been for Australia.
Industry professor at University of Technology Sydney and airport economist Tim Harcourt speaking there with Roderick Chambers. No,
doesn't make sense to me. If your dollars don't make sense, listen to On the Money.
This week, former Australia Post CEO Christine Holgate gave evidence at a parliamentary inquiry into her dismissal from the position last year, after it was revealed she spent thousands of dollars on Cartier watches for Australia Post executives. I spoke with Jason Harris, Professor of Corporate Law at the University of Sydney, about how government business enterprises like Australia Post function.
So Australia Post is really interesting because it started off life as part of the Postmaster General's department, so basically a public authority. But then we've got the Australian Postal Corporation Act of 1989. So it is set up as a statutory corporation, and that means that the provisions that govern its internal operation, like who can be a director, what sort of powers the shareholder has, how do you hold a board meeting, what sort of powers does management have, those sorts of things, they're not governed solely by the Corporations Act, which applies to most companies, but rather they're governed by their own specific statute. And one thing that's a point of difference here, you know, if we think about the watches scandal, for example, that in a regular corporation that's just set up under the Corporations Act, directors, of course, have the duty to act in the best interest of the company. And some people would say that that means that the company is a commercial entity and all of its stakeholders, employees, customers, suppliers, in addition to shareholders. Some others would say the company means only the shareholders. Well, for a statutory corporation, it's subject to various laws, including the Public Governance Performance and Accountability Act, which is a federal statute. And that basically allows the finance minister to tell the company what to do. So the finance minister, with the government being the sole shareholder, can effectively pass government rules that then say, you have to run the company in this way, or that the company can't be entering into this sort of business, or the company has to engage in this sort of business. You wouldn't normally have that in a standard company. The shareholders can't tell the board of directors or the management of the company what to do. Now, if they're not happy with what management are doing, then they can vote out directors, vote in new directors who they think are going to hold management to account better. But it's very clear with private companies that the shareholders don't get to tell management what to do. And yet for government-owned corporations, because they're subject to specific statutes like the Public Governance Performance and Accountability Act, are subject to slightly different rules.
With the watches scandal, the board of Australia Post said that they actually didn't give authorisation for that to happen. Yep. So what power does the board of Australia Post have?
The watches scandal it demonstrates a problem with corporate governance inside Australia Post, and that is that there just were not clear enough guidelines about how Australia Post money should be spent. So spending money on a bonus for executives who win a massive contract for the company, that's pretty standard. You know, most people wouldn't quibble with that. If you're bringing in a lot of new business, you should be rewarded for that. But it's the decision about how to reward them, how to spend the company's money. So it's not the fact that they got a reward. If they just got a one-off pay increase for that year, no one would have batted an eyelid. It's the fact that they bought luxury watches. So companies, all companies, government-owned companies and private companies, need to have very clear guidelines in place about what they expect of their management and how the company's funds should be used. And anytime you're providing gifts or bonuses or things of that nature to the company's senior management, there's clearly a risk of management, you know, trying to misuse those rules for their own benefit. Now, I'm not in any way suggesting that the CEO did that here, but that's why we have these guidelines, is to make it clear to everyone that the people who are making these decisions are making appropriate decisions. Now, I personally don't have any problem with buying the luxury watches. It demonstrates that there's a bigger problem inside the corporation, that they don't have those clear guidelines about if you're going to be doing the bonuses, then here are the checks and balances that you need to go through. So based on what we've been told in the public domain, it seems that the CEO believed that the chair was suggesting to her that she pay bonuses, but there was no guidance about what form the bonuses should take, and so she made the decision to buy watches.
The main difference with like a normal corporation and Australia Post would be that Australia Post is government run. What does Australia Post have to do in order to line up with their community service obligations? And does that still mean that they should be paying bonuses and incentives out?
I think the community service obligations are a slightly separate issue because, I mean, their job is to deliver post, and clearly we've seen over the last few years that the profitability of the standard letter delivery service is not what it once was. And if this was just a standard private corporation, you know, that they might actually think, let's not deliver letters anymore because we can't make money on it. Let's just stick to delivering parcels and, you know, work for Amazon and whatever. So I think that's slightly different. I mean, clearly under their statute, they have an obligation to do that. But in terms of more broader community expectations or community standards, the fact that it is a government-owned corporation, clearly politicians feel like, you know, that they can tell Australia Post what to do. And I think that the thing that started the whole furor when the former CEO was before Senate Estimates and just kind of made the offhand remark that watches were bought and then copped the criticism from the Senate committee and then responded by saying, well, you know, it's not taxpayer money. We're a private corporation. We just happen to have only one shareholder, which is the government. So the government corporations, government-owned corporations, pose a particular challenge in corporate governance because normally we would say, okay, yeah, we've got to think about the interests of shareholders, but we're not beholden to shareholders. Well, the difficulty here is that all the board are appointed by the minister through the Governor General. The idea is, you know, we're giving them management power. If the shareholders as a whole aren't happy, then the shareholders can vote them out. But there's not usually one shareholder who can do that. Whereas in government-owned corporations, it's different. If the government doesn't like what you're doing, regardless of whether what you're doing is legal or not, they can sack you. They can get rid of you very quickly. And if we want to hold these government-owned corporations up to the corporate governance standards of public companies, then we need to provide a framework where the directors and the management of these government-owned corporations can make decisions in the best interests of the corporation and its stakeholders and don't feel beholden to their sole shareholder.
That was Jason Harris, Professor of Corporate Law, talking with me there.
Money. Ride the gravy train with us.
The recent release of a joint statement on merger control enforcement by competition regulators from Australia, the UK and Germany has raised questions about the regulation of tech monopolies. Additionally, a recent federal court case between the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission and Google found that Google had misled some users about personal location data that Google had collected. Gabriella Montero asked George Tian, senior lecturer at UTS Law School, how tech monopolies are currently regulated in Australia.
So generally speaking, actually, when we're dealing with technology, actually, the main legislation and cover technology, I think it should be the intellectual property law and copyright law and trademark law and the patent law. They're all dealing with, actually, technology and the inventions.
Recently, competition regulators from Australia, the UK and Germany released a joint statement on merger control enforcement to regulate monopolies. How does merger regulation, particularly international merger regulation, function to control the influence of tech monopolies?
Yeah, I saw the statement. Actually, it seems like those agencies, they would like to work together to strengthen actually the merger control, which I think is quite necessary. And the reason is because when we deal with the merger control, actually now the merger acquisition actually is become actually increasingly important and also have some cross-border features. So that means actually the merger acquisition actually in Australia and may affect the market competition actually in other countries. And also when you talk about actually the potential impact for the technology, I think actually it's quite right because digital technology actually makes all the cross-border transaction become much easier than before. But from the statement, I think actually maybe it's just a starting point for the corporation.
Yeah, I think you're right. It is just a starting point at the moment. But what impact could this type of regulation have, not just for the companies themselves, but consumers?
When we deal with the merger acquisition, actually, in the competition law context, actually, the consumer will be protected actually indirectly by protecting competition order in the market. And that will force actually all the competitor actually improve the quality of the product and service and also reduce the price. But if we don't have a control and assume just like the big telecommunication provider, they just conduct merger acquisition, that means actually the consumer will have less choice. So eventually actually those big telecommunication provider maybe became the monopolist and the consumer certainly will be suffered. So the competition law, I will say actually, is more just protect consumer in an indirect way.
On the note of regulation of digital companies, the Australian Federal Court recently found that Google had misled users about personal location data. What happened with this case?
Before we move to that case, actually, a little bit of background. Actually, we need to make a small distinction between the competition law and the consumer law. And for example, actually, the merger acquisition issue you just mentioned, actually, that falls into the category of the competition law. And the issue, actually, you mentioned about actually the recent Google case, actually, they fall into the ACL's jurisdiction. The reality is actually the HPC found actually the when we use Google Mobile, actually, normally speaking, when we set up the Google account, we will have option to set up actually the location history. And from the Google's statement, all the user will feel actually the location history setting is only way for the Google to collect and keep our personal data. So if we disable the location history setting, that means actually Google cannot collect our data in relation to our location anymore. But the ACCC found actually it's not true. The reason is because in addition to the location history setting, actually the Google have another setting called the web and app activity setting. From the title, we assume just like it's just dealing with web and app application. But as a matter of fact, that setting also enables Google to collect, store, and personal location data. And that setting was turned on by default. But Google and hasn't disclosed this information to the customer. Basically, Google still can collect all the information.
This decision has been called the first of its kind. Why is this decision about Google so important?
It's certainly important because actually Google is a big company and have the platform and also have the software actually to collect personal data. As a matter of fact, not only Google. So when we just take advantage from the free app and we download from the iPhone or Samsung smartphone, Android phone, actually, sometimes actually it's not really free because what we pay is all personal data, personal information. And if the app developer actually, if they make a misleading statement, they collecting the user's data, but they claim actually they haven't. And definitely actually the user will make wrong judgment, and definitely it's bad for the consumer and also bad for the privacy protection in general. And Google is a big company, and if ACCC actually succeed, and definitely actually the all other app developers, they must be very careful. And since Google already lost the case.
How can proper regulation of digital and tech companies be achieved when many operate on an international basis?
That's one of the challenges, because every country actually they have different regulation. For example, and when we're dealing with the personal data, as an example, every country they have a different data protection law, and some countries even don't have data protection law. So in that case, actually, when we transfer the data from one country to another, particularly by the multinational company, and definitely, actually, there's potential just like breach the law in different jurisdictions. At the same time, actually, also have a regulation dealing with, for example, if any company, for example, if they using collecting the Australian citizens' data, and then they pass those data and to other countries, for example, United States, India or other countries. And those companies, actually, they should have obligation. Make sure, actually, the data, the country in which, actually, the data will be transferred to, and they will provide same levels of privacy protection as the Australian citizen can receive in Australia. And also, we have some bilateral treaty and international treaties dealing with this type of matters. Not perfect, but we do have some legislation dealing with this type of issues.
That was George Tian, senior lecturer at UTS Law School, speaking there with Gabriella Montero. I'm Sophia Tarek, and you're listening to On the Money, around Australia on the Community Radio Network. That's all the time we have for On the Money this week. Tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about finance, business, and the economy. Thanks to our executive producer, Roderick Chambers, and producer, Gabriella Montero. On the Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER for the Community Radio Network and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find all our shows and stories at 2ser.com/onthemoney. Subscribe to our podcasts and find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Look for @onthemoney2ser. I'm Sophia Tarek. We'll be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Do stay well, and thanks for your company.